Reading from Master's Commentary on the Gita, Chapter 3, Verse 2. Arjuna continues, "With these apparently conflicting speeches, thou art, as it were, confusing my intelligence. Please let me know for certain that one thing by which I will achieve the highest good." Master's Commentary. Your counsel, though eloquent and assuredly wise, is seemingly contradictory. My grasping power is bewildered by your subtly conflicting words. Can you not simply point out to me that one portal which leads directly into the palace of perfection? This typifies the psychological state of the devotee whose understanding is not yet finely attuned to intuition. He is often confused by the apparently contradictory advice from the scriptures or his guru. For example, when a master once told his disciple, "You must eat and you mustn't eat," the disciple replied, "Master, I do not understand. Your commands are contradictory." The master replied, "True, you do not understand. My advice is perfectly harmonious. What I mean is that you must eat when you are truly hungry, only to give proper nutrition to your body for the maintaining of your temple, of your soul. But you must not eat when you are tempted by deep-seated wicked appetite of greed, under the guidance of which you will overeat and destroy your health." Similarly, whenever Krishna advises, in essence, "Live in this world, but do not live in it," he meant that man should live and fulfill his duties in this world, since God put him here. But he should not live in attachment to its wiles and ways. Spiritual advice is often paradoxical. Far from being contradictory, it rather reflects the inadequacy of corporal expression to convey that which is above this familiar, this or that duality of nature. Among Christian saints, how given to paradoxes is St. John of the Cross in his mystical poesy, "The Music Without Sound." With fire that can consume and yet do no harm, eternal life you render and change my death to life, even while killing. The music without sound, with fire that can consume and yet do no harm, eternal life you render, and change my death to life, even while killing. Jesus said, "For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, but whosoever will lose his life for my sake, the same shall save. God is the great paradox, the sole life, the only being, yet invisible, intangible, the formless, and the every form. In spiritual life, worldly standards are reversed. Sell all thou hast and give to the poor. Take no thought for the morrow. These uncompromising reversals of common sense are dismissed by the average man as bewildering or paradoxical. Arjuna is thus confused at the advice of his guru. Krishna, who extols wisdom as superior to action, and at the same time advises him to act." Speaking to someone on the phone the other day, and I'd had this book by Eckhart Tolle, a current day sage, titled A New Earth, and I had not picked it up to read it. So the individual is asking me about it, and so I just picked it up and read from this portion here, "Entertainment, the Media, and the Pain Body." If you were not familiar with our contemporary civilization, if you had come here from another age or another planet, one of the things that would amaze you is the millions of people love and pay money to watch humans kill and inflict pain on each other and call it entertainment. Why do violent films attract such large audiences? There is an entire industry, a large part of which fuels the human addiction to unhappiness. People obviously watch those films because they want to feel bad. What is it in humans that loves to feel bad and calls it good? The pain body, of course. A large part of the entertainment industry caters to it. So, in addition to reactivity, negative thinking, and personal drama, the pain body also renews itself vicariously through the cinema and television screen. Pain bodies write and produce these films, and pain bodies pay to watch them. It is always wrong to show and watch violence on television. Is it always wrong to show and watch violence on television and the cinema screen? Does all such violence cater to the pain body? At the current evolutionary stage of humanity, violence is still not only all-pervasive, but even on the increase, as old egoic consciousness, amplified by the collective pain body, intensifies prior to its inevitable demise. If films show violence in its wider context, if they show its origin and its consequences, show what it does to the victim as well as the perpetrator, show the collective unconsciousness that lies behind it and is passed on from generation to generation, the anger and hatred that lives in humans as the pain body, then these films can fulfill a vital function in the awakening of humanity. They can act as a mirror in which humanity sees its own insanity. That in you which recognizes madness as madness, even if it is your own, is sanity. Is the arising awareness is the end of insanity. Such films do exist, and they do not fuel the pain body. Some of the best anti-war films are films that show the reality of war rather than glamorized version of it. The pain body can only feed on films in which violence is portrayed as normal or even desirable human behavior, or that glorify violence with the sole purpose of generating negative emotion in the viewer, and so become a fix for the pain-addicted pain body. The popular tabloid press does not primarily sell news but negative emotion. Food from the pain body, outrage, screams, the three-inch headlines, or bastards. The British tabloid press excels at this. They know that negative emotion sells far more papers than news does. There's a tendency in the news media in general, including television, to thrive on negative news. The worse things get, the more excited the presenters become, and often the negative excitement is generated by media itself. Pain bodies just love it. Well, I thought this was a very interesting perspective on the idea of violence, of war, of current-day news media. And in particular with the media, I agree with him. But when it comes to war and people's delight or draw to see movies about conflicts and fights and that kind of thing, I think it's more mixed than what he presents. There are indeed some movies that glorify the violence, and there's no real context other than the victory of one over another and the violence that ensues as a result. This is for a portion of humanity. But I think the greater films, the larger selling films, are ones that portray a heroic journey. The Saving of Private Ryan comes to mind as a movie about heroes who were trying to do something good within a violent context. It was historical, and these kind of things actually happened. And so we see there that the attraction is not towards the violence itself, but towards the hero's journey. And that oftentimes the hero's journey is taken through difficulty, great difficulty, sometimes violence, sometimes catastrophes of extraordinary measure. Now, the Bhagavad Gita is based itself on a battle. Mahatma Gandhi, who is a great pacifist, also loved the Bhagavad Gita, and he saw it as something that was completely allegory in nature. But life itself is not an allegory. Life itself is something that happens around us. And we have many times been witness to violent acts. We have been a party to them, perhaps, in some way or another. Or we participate with them by watching them as what is called here as entertainment. And so what are we to make of such things? Are they all bad in that sense? And if they're only against violence, then is that the only thing that's edifying about them? The hero's journey within us all is a universal theme. We find it throughout the world. In the Ramayana, we see the hero's journey of Rama as he goes out and is exiled with his wife and his brother. And they wander and they go into many scrapes and many battles and finally overcome ultimate evil and return. And throughout it all, there are violent effects, there are events, there are wars, and so on. And we find with many of the great epics that this is so. And yet, our teachings and that which we strive to achieve is a state of perfect equanimity and peace. And so we seek to go beyond the things of this world, beyond anger, beyond jealousy, beyond greed, those very things that many times instigate war and violence. And yet in this text, Krishna is advocating for Arjuna to engage in the battle, that it is necessary. And here Krishna represents the highest divine intelligence and consciousness. And so this is where Arjuna gets confused. At one time, Krishna is saying, attainment of this highest divine consciousness, which is beyond all conflicts and fights, is what you're here to do. And he's also encouraging him to go out onto the battlefield and engage in the battle. And so Arjuna, justifiably so from a human standpoint, is saying, I don't get it. I don't understand this completely. Please explain it to me. Because if I'm to achieve complete peace and God realization, then I would rather just go to a cave, if you don't mind very much, and just take my time and focus my attention within. And yet Krishna is definitely telling him not to do this. And so we take the story and we see through the Gita pages how Krishna again and again advocates for Arjuna to engage in the battle, but to do it without any attachment for an end product. Why do it then? Because it is the right thing to do. It is his dharma. He was born as a warrior. That we need to have people of high consciousness who are willing to step forward and be the protectors of society. This is the Kshatriya class. It is the ruler-warrior class. And if we do not have that, then we have what would be an analogous to a schoolyard bully who would intimidate and dominate an entire class because nobody had the courage to stand up to that one. Or you would have a villain operating within a community and no one would be willing to stand up as a policeman to say, this is enough, this is against the law, this must stop. And I'm going to take whatever steps are necessary in order to stop you. Now, to behave with dharma means that you behave according to a higher set of rules. You don't just react out of anger. In fact, anger is your enemy. You don't react out of fear. You don't react out of greed. You do it because it's the right thing to do. And you're being guided by the highest light that you know in that moment. When you do this and you're called upon to do it, this is your role in life to do so, then you are fulfilling your highest calling within this life. Now, this can also occur within what we might call less violent kinds of settings, and yet there is conflict. Somebody is a psychological or emotional bully. They play the emotional blackmail game. If you don't do what I want you to do, then I'll become extremely angry. Or I'll become extremely depressed and I'll just withdraw from you. And as a result, you're now at the other person's mercy. And it's not a pretty sight. It's not being guided by light. It's not being guided by wisdom. And so you stand up to it. You become a warrior in a sense. Now, it's not a violent field of action in a physical kind of sense, but certainly in an emotional sense it can be. And so you stand up for what you know to be the very best thing for you to do in those circumstances. Sometimes it's being in a group of people and telling the truth when it's a very uncomfortable thing to do. And others may ridicule you. They may put you down. They may snicker at you or make fun of you. And so this is something that you put yourself into the field of battle for. And Jesus warned us not to dangle your pearls before swine. So you don't necessarily go out and give your most intimate details of your life, or your sacred life in particular, to people who have little or no understanding of it. Because, as he says, they will turn around and rend you. And this is the truth. They'll make fun of you. They'll ridicule you. They'll take the kind of things that you say and they'll turn it against you. And so you do give truth freely when you're called upon to do it, when you feel that intuitive drive to do so. And then you draw out some of your pearls and you place them out and you see how they're handled. If they're handled with care, with love, with respect. And if they are not, then you put them back away again. So all of this world is one in which there is conflict, which there are fights, which there are battles. And if we are too averse to enter into any of them, then we give way to those who would do evil in this world, who would misuse their free will. So it's not an easy thing to do. It's not an easy thing to do. And these are many, many times, as I say, completely without conflict in terms of killing or shooting or those kinds of things. And yet, they take a great deal of courage to stand up to those whom perhaps you admire or respect, or you want their admiration or their respect. And so you don't back down. You keep going. You keep going forward. I know in my own case that as I entered into my spiritual sadhana, I didn't talk to a lot of people about it. Every once in a while, I'd enter into a conversation with it, and the words would just flow. And the other person was interested. And when I did that, it was a very uplifting kind of time. There might be other times when I would try to talk about my spiritual path and the words came out all jumbled. They didn't make any sense to me. I can't imagine they made any sense to the other person. And so I knew to shut up then and not to continue. And so we learn through our own experience in this way when to speak and when to hold our peace. But never do we give in to fear. Never do we avoid the field of conflict when we get called upon it. Now, I do agree with Eckhart Tolle here that there are people who deliberately go out to create conflicts and fights. I was amazed when I was working with a group that people within this group, oftentimes the way that they joined into the group is they picked a fight with somebody. And they would have a big old fight. They deliberately set out to do it, and they'd have a big old fight, and then they'd feel relaxed. They'd feel all right because they were now on familiar terms. And if other people could tolerate them, then all right. They felt like they were family now, and that's how they joined. And in that sense, you can say that we get addicted to these negative emotions, and we're driven by them, and we're attracted to them. If you're in with a group of people and suddenly, for some reason, there's a fight, you know, there's some people who are instantly drawn to that, and other people who are repulsed by it. And so when people are drawn to things like this, and they go in for it, there is a kind of an addiction that goes on there. But what I've discovered through long investigation into the interior lives, not only of myself, but of others, is that ultimately we are not drawn to things in order to derive pain from them. There's always a part inside of us who's always calculating, this will be for my highest happiness. This will be for my highest happiness. Now, it can be very convoluted thinking at times, and very twisted kind of reasoning that goes along, tortured reasoning, really, in order to reach that conclusion. But the drug addict, the alcoholic, the abusive husband or wife, they can all be driven by what they think is going to achieve their highest happiness. Even mass murderers. They are striving, unsuccessfully in most cases, to attain a level of bliss, of peace, of joy. And they're trying to find it by illicit means, by things that will become dead ends for them. And worse than dead ends, they'll fall off cliffs. And then they'll have to work very, very hard in order to get themselves back up to any place that they would call happy once again. So we see people that are all striving for happiness, even though it's very, very misguided. So I don't think that people in general are really addicted to pain. What they're addicted to is bliss. But they've misidentified what the source of their bliss is. They've come to see that the bottom of that bottle, or that drug syringe, or that violence, or whatever means they have of trying to attain it, is their attempt at finding that bliss. And so sin, in its original meaning, meant missing the goal, like an archer would miss his target. And so these individuals, you can say, are in sinful nature in that they are striving for bliss, but they're missing the target. They're not getting it. They're not seeing it. And so they're not getting the results. And oftentimes, that just drives them even harder. They strive harder to get to that bliss because they're missing it so much. Now, you can't necessarily convince somebody of that who's involved in that kind of behavior that their behavior is wrong, or that it's not going to get them their end. They're very convinced of it. And if they're not convinced of it, they're too afraid to try to do something different. And this leads to another problem. There are people who do not have the courage to change their own lives. They're too full of fear. They're too full of, I want what I want in the moment. And so they just do whatever is easy. They do whatever works for them in the moment without any real care or understanding of what happens to other people. Individuals like this are like black holes that will suck all the life energy of anybody who's around them if they let them. And you could pour in your whole self into an individual like that, and they would take it and it would disappear and be gone in a second. And they wouldn't think anything of it. They would just go on to the next one. And on they go. They have no courage. They have no strength. They just move on to the next easy target. And you may classify these people as evil, in a sense, because they create catastrophe and broken relationships and broken people wherever they go. They don't help this world. They don't bring light to this world. In fact, they suck the light out as fast as they can. And so we need to learn to recognize when we're in a healthy relationship and when we can give to somebody and it builds something good, or we're just simply giving to somebody and it's just absorbed and taken into nowhere. and were left completely depleted as a result. We give, but we give with wisdom as God chooses to give through us. And when we recognize that a relationship is an unhealthy one, then we withdraw from it in the sense that we quit giving our all to it. We give through wisdom, not just out of the impulse to give. And so all of us are on this field of battle. We're all on this earth. And there are many, many circumstances, and we can't just look for what serves us in the moment or what's the easy way in order to go. We're following a hero's path in the sense that we leave what's known to us. Spiritually, we leave our hometown. We leave those familiar precincts where we have grown up. We strive to grow in consciousness. That means we have to enter into new territory, unknown territory. And this is a terrifying thing for the human ego, because the human ego likes to know its boundaries. It likes to know where it's at. It likes to know what the score is, because it's not wanting to put itself at risk. And it's only when we cultivate faith, faith in a God that is all-providing, that directs our life, that will give us everything that we need as we go along on this journey. And when you do this, and you strive to live with that with all of your heart, your mind, your strength, and your soul, then you really put yourself on the path. And it takes courage. It takes courage, very definitely. And you put one foot in front of the other. So one thing we should all do in our spiritual journey, because the ego wants to get complacent, its default is to rest where it is. But in a spiritual thinking, there's no neutrality. You're either going forward or you're going backward. And so you have to assess yourself at times. Am I just going along with what's familiar? Am I just kind of a little bit on cruise control here? I'm not making any real spiritual effort. We had a wonderful day of silence and meditation yesterday. And during this time, God can take the listening, waiting soul and lift it into higher regions. And that happened for me yesterday. And I had a wonderful vision of Sri Yukteswar. Sri Yukteswar is not one of the great masters that I'm oftentimes feel in communion with, but yesterday was a wonderful time. And as his visage appeared before me, I felt such tremendous gratitude, such tremendous respect for this great, great God-man. And he shone with an internal luster. And then suddenly, language appeared of Sanskrit and pictograph kind of nature to it. And I knew that he was conveying something to me, but consciously I couldn't quite grasp what it was, so I just remained as receptive as I could to what it was that he was conveying, and I felt certain that something had been transferred, but I didn't fully comprehend it in my conscious mind. I assume that it's something that will reveal itself with time. And so when we make this effort to go inside, to still the mind, to still the senses, to still the body, then a wonderful reflectivity begins to happen. We begin to reflect the light that's constantly shining, the Purusha, the divine intelligence, that's always shining upon you. You see, we're all receiving grace. We're all receiving light. We're receiving it all the time. We live in a sea of God. And yet, how many realize it, you see? Because we run around and we're preoccupied with all the little things that this mind gets focused on. And we don't really take the time and make the effort to know who and what we really are. You are something wonderful. Wonderful. You are vast in spirit. You are without limits. The mind always wants to put limits on something. And if you have an experience of God, or if you gain a certain amount of realization, The mind would just like to cap it off, okay, I'm happy with that. So it wants to consolidate. It wants to bring in a wall around you. Even if it's an expanded, all right, that's okay, but that's far enough, says the ego. And so we must always be willing to challenge ourselves, to go deeper, to go higher, to not be self-satisfied with what we have. And even when you rise into the higher precincts of spirit, and you feel the bliss and the communion with God, and unless and until that human ego has totally disappeared, and only God shines out through every cell, through every speck of your being, you have not yet completed your journey. And there are those few who ascend high, but they cap off the experience. And if you were to analyze it, you would see that they are attached to something at some point that keeps them from going the whole way. There are very, very few who have that complete and total emancipation. Not because it's not possible, but because there are so few who are ready and willing to give of themselves 1,000%, not leaving anything for themselves, but giving themselves heart, mind, and soul to the divine communion. The irony is, when you do this, you attain complete freedom. Through complete submission, you get complete freedom. A quote here from Swami Ram Dass. Faith and practice combined can enable an aspirant to overcome any and every difficulty that confronts him in a struggle for control of the mind. Surely the kripa or grace of a saint is essential. Under his guidance and influence, the sadhaka progresses rapidly towards the goal. But your own effort is also essential. Tamasic inactivity or rajasic activity are obstacles. A selfless and one-pointed endeavor is alone conducive to real concentration and the ultimate attainment. Your life is in your hands. Elevate it, purify it, and fill it with your bliss of immortality. May God within you be your guide. Such a great, great God-man. And we are just so fortunate to have the influence and the guidance of Papa, of Master, of Mother, of Sri Yukteswarji, of all the great and blessed masters who have bestowed their blessings upon us. One time somebody was asking Mother, or Master rather, and said, I need your blessings in order to change. And Master said, God's blessings you have, my blessings you have. The only thing that is needed now are your blessings. And isn't this the truth? That God's grace is always flowing to us, that Guru's grace is always flowing to us. They could not withhold it from us, not even if they wanted to, and there is no reason not to. But we restrict it through our own habit, through our own habit. It is true that there are those who thrive and sell on negativity and on pain. But the bigger truth, the deeper truth, is that we are all striving to commune with our one blessed Lord, and to gain that complete and total peace, that bliss, that soul wisdom and light that comes with realization. Once this world becomes oriented in this way, once it recognizes that this is the true source of happiness, then watch the world run for the divine light. Now today it seems as if the world runs away from that light. In reality, they just haven't properly identified what the real source of happiness is. They think that by having their own way, by having their own freedom, by doing whatever it is that they want to do, that they will gain freedom in that way. But the paradox is that they become more and more enslaved, not more free. Papa said that freedom comes not through license of activity, but by complete and total submission and surrender to God. This is opposite thinking, isn't it, to what the worldly mind tells you? So sing to God day and night. Keep your mind upon God. Feel that when you go about your worldly activities, that God is moving through you. And if you are faced with a situation that requires courage, that requires you to go against another individual or even the prevailing attitudes of many, then have the courage to do it. To stand your ground, not of anger, not out of greed, not out of fear, but out of the inner light that is prompting you to do so. When each and every one of us does that, evil will disappear from this earth. But we must have the courage to grow. That is the greatest antidote to evil. And when we see examples in the news and in other places of people who are not following a dharmic life, let us not be disheartened, but let us take that as a reminder. This is what happens. There are as many stories right now of individuals and groups that have gone out and misrepresented themselves and really have stolen millions and billions of dollars. And it's a terrible, terrible thing. It costs. It costs in so many ways. It costs materially. It costs emotionally. It costs spiritually. And these individuals who thought they were doing something in secret now have it shouted from the rooftops. And they don't like it very much. So let us let that serve us as a reminder to serve with integrity, with honesty, with sincerity, and learn to be free in spirit. Be free in spirit. If you will pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious Spirit in every part of my being. My heart bursts with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet, and I surrender myself to Thee. I feel the perfection of Thy soul moving through every part of my being. Love pervades my body, mind, and heart. And I melt in the sea of consciousness of Thee. Peace. Amen.